This program is brought to you by Resonance 104.4 FM. If you like what you hear and want to support our work, please make a donation at fundraiser.resonance.fm.
Listening to Resonance 104.4 FM, and this is Wavelength, hosted by me, William English. So Resonance 104.4 FM and resonancefm.com on the net. And today is Friday, the 29th of March, 2019. So what with one thing and another and another and another, this seems an opportune moment to play an LP called Europe Since the War, the story of 10 years of European cooperation, narrated by Lord Boothby, and issued on the Argo label in 1960, with the voices of 20 European statesmen, including Churchill, Adenauer, and Ernest Bevin. Both sides of the record amount to approximately 50 minutes, so I'll just let it run with a slight break to turn the LP over. And accompanying this broadcast is a record of G.I. Gurdjieff improvising on a harmonium, which I recently acquired. It's called G.I. Gurdjieff Improvisations. Gurdjieff was an Armenian and Greek philosopher, spiritual teacher and musician, whose teachings of the fourth way influenced thousands worldwide and created communities that still exist to this day. His goal was to teach humans to reach a higher consciousness out of the waking sleep he considered most to be living in. Music was an important part of his teachings, and these brilliant harmonium improvisations were recorded in 1949 in Paris, just a short time before his death. So that will sort of act as a sort of, what shall we call it, an undercurrent throughout the European broadcast. And then at the end of the broadcast, I shall play a short track by the artist Rodney Graham called File Under Europop, from the CD The Bedbug Love Buzz, recorded in 1998.
Europe Since the War. The story of 10 years of European cooperation.
What is the plight to which Europe has been reduced? Some of the smaller states have indeed made a good recovery, but over wide areas, a vast quivering mass of tormented, hungry, careworn, and bewildered human beings gape at the ruins of their cities and their homes, and scan the dark horizons for the approach of some new peril, tyranny, or terror. Among the victors, there is a babel of voices. Among the vanquished, the sullen silence of despair.
Well, I'm sure that you recognize that voice. Yes, it's Winston Churchill, speaking at Zurich in Switzerland in 1946, just after the war. And After describing the desperate state to which Europe had brought itself, Churchill added that there was a way out, a way by which Europe could be restored to health.
What is this sovereign remedy? It is to recreate the European family, or as much of it as we can, and to provide it with a structure under which it can dwell in peace, in safety, and in freedom. We must build a kind of United States of Europe. In this way only will hundreds of millions of toilers be able to regain the simple joys and hopes which make life worth living.
To tell you the story of how and how far Europe has succeeded in uniting, and with what results, is Lord Boothby.
Europe after the war was a sorry sight. In most countries, the war had caused vast material damage which was still unrepaired. Even those countries that had escaped bombing, invasion, or occupation had had their industries dislocated, their trade with other countries ruined, their traditional sources of supply cut off. To restore Europe to its peacetime prosperity was obviously going to be a long and difficult job. Then the United States made an offer since described as the most unsordid act in history. During and after the war, the United States had given considerable help to its individual European allies. Now there was a change of policy. America was still ready to help, and on a greater scale than ever before. But its assistance would go to Europe as a whole, and Europe must also help herself. The European countries must themselves agree how best to use the resources to be made available to them. The American Secretary of State, the late General George Marshall, put it in these words.
It is already evident that before the United States government can proceed much further in its efforts to alleviate the situation and help start the European world on its way to recovery, there must be some agreement among the countries of Europe as to the requirements of the situation and the part those countries themselves will take in order to give a proper effect to whatever action might be undertaken by this government. It would be neither fitting nor efficacious for our government to undertake to draw up unilaterally a program designed to place Europe on its feet economically. This is the business of the Europeans. The initiative, I think, must come from Europe. The role of this country should consist of friendly aid in the drafting of the European program and of later support of such a program, so far as it may be practical for us to do so. Program should be a joint, agreed to by a number, if not all, European nations.
Talks on this offer began immediately between the British, French, and Russian foreign ministers. But Mr. Molotov insisted that all that was needed was a list of individual needs and refused to concede that the organization responsible for distributing the aid should have any say in how it was used. So, when a little later the European countries were invited to a conference to draw up together a balance sheet of Europe's resources and needs, only one communist country accepted, and she was later obliged by Russia to withdraw. The Iron Curtain had shut down on economic cooperation. The 16 countries that did respond to the invitation managed to agree in a remarkably short time, not only on the division of the aid for which they were going to ask the United States, but also on something even more important: to set up an organization in which each country would work together in economic matters with its neighbors. This new body was called the Organization for European Economic Cooperation, OEEC, and its headquarters were set up in Paris.
Here is the late Ernest Bevin, then British Secretary of State for Foreign Affairs, in a speech recorded by the BBC in July 1948.
Mr. Ambassador, sir, the signature of this agreement formally brings into operation the European Recovery Program for the United Kingdom. Similar agreements are going into force with the other participating countries. These agreements mark the fulfillment of an outstanding feat of constructive statesmanship. I remember well the deep feeling with which I heard over the wireless Mr. Marshall's great speech at Harvard a year ago last June. It was a speech from one continent to another, saying, in fact, get together, put up your plan, and we will try to carry it out. And it was one which few, in the light of the European situation, could resist. I believe that we and our friends who now make up the organization of the European Economic Cooperation have played our part well. In the short time, and a year in matters of this kind is a short time, we and the other participating countries have worked together in a great cooperative effort. Now, our task is defined. Our mutual undertakings have been settled, and we can go forward to achieve that economic stability in Europe which alone can make enduring peace possible.
OEEC has done good work for Europe. It is, in fact, within its framework that our countries have conducted their economic relations with each other for more than 10 years, conducted them efficiently and successfully, with the active assistance of Canada and the United States. OEEC was set up in April 1948. The next month was to give stronger proof that a new spirit was abroad in Europe, springing from the realization that all our countries had gained by fighting one another was poverty and a desperate weakness in the face of an expansionist Russia. In May 1948, nearly 1,000 private citizens from 24 European countries, including several representatives of governments in exile, met at The Hague. It was in every way a remarkable gathering. It included many of Europe's best known and most influential statesmen. It produced concrete proposals for unifying Europe, and it had the satisfaction of seeing, 1 year later, what seemed to be the essential part of these proposals adopted. What did the Hague Congress call for? Listen to the message to Europeans adopted at the final plenary session of the Hague Congress.
We desire a united Europe throughout whose area the free movement of persons, ideas, and goods is restored. We desire a charter of human rights guaranteeing liberty of thought, assembly, and expression. We desire a court of justice with adequate sanctions for the implementation of this charter. We desire a European assembly where the live forces of all our nations shall be represented.
1 year after the Congress, the Statute of the Council of Europe was signed by the representatives of 10 countries at St. James's Palace in London. 5 more European democratic countries joined the Council within the first year of its existence, amongst them the German Federal Republic, which was already a member of OEEC. To hear in Strasbourg the first German members of Parliament speaking in the midst of their French and other European colleagues was one of the most moving and inspiring moments in the early days of the Council. This is Mr. Gerstenmaier, now President of the Bundestag, speaking in August 1950.
Meine verehrten Kollegen, durch Ihre Einladung an uns haben Sie uns Deutschen eine Möglichkeit gegeben, uns selbst wiederzufinden. und aus der Wüste und der Zerstörung, in die wir durch eine verbrecherische Tyrannei verbannt waren, wieder herauszukommen. Wir Deutsche, meine Damen und Herren, fühlen uns genauso wenig wie Sie dort heimisch, wo Freiheit und Gerechtigkeit unterdrückt werden. Wir fühlen uns heimisch hier, innerhalb der Gemeinschaft der freien Nationen. Wir möchten für alle Zeiten zu den Völkern gehören, denen die Freiheit und die Gerechtigkeit wichtiger sind als ihr Leben.
The statute of the council seemed to follow closely what the Hague Congress had demanded. It set up a European consultative assembly so that for the first time members of parliament were called upon to take part in what can be termed parliamentary diplomacy. Respect for human rights was made a condition of membership. Clearly, the Council of Europe was something new, something which aroused great interest and enormous hopes. But in fact, the Council wasn't altogether what it seemed. It was a compromise between those who wanted a federation like the United States of America and those who feared to go beyond intergovernmental cooperation. The Council had its parliamentary assembly, but its only powers were those of recommendation. And the members of the executive body of the Council, a committee of foreign ministers, were each armed with the right of veto. In this situation, the British attitude was all important. Of course, Franco-German reconciliation was also vital, but there were, even then, many signs that this reconciliation was well underway. The choice of Strasbourg as the Council's seat was only one of them. The unknown and the crucial factor was this: what would be Britain's attitude towards a continent seeking its unity? Unhappily, it soon became apparent that it was to be one of extreme prudence, hedged around with innumerable reservations. Let us listen to some of these early debates in the Consultative Assembly. The first question which arose was that of the nature of the union to be reached with the members of the Council. The Assembly had on its agenda the following item: consideration of any necessary changes in the political structure of Europe to achieve greater unity.
On the 16th of August, 1949, Monsieur André Philippe stated,
Si nous voulons créer l'Europe, si nous voulons unifier en un marché commun cette Europe qui ne peut vivre qu'unie, sous peine de connaître la catastrophe et les crises les plus graves dans un délai plus bref que certains ne le pensent, il faut au point de départ affirmer comme le but que nous voulons atteindre le plus rapidement possible la création d'une autorité politique européenne à caractère supranational.
Already the words common market are spoken. Already the ultimate goal of a European federation of states is implicit. But most of the British representatives, followed by the Scandinavians and the Irish, refused the theories of the constitutionalists and invoked their own traditional empiricism. Above all, they were chary of handing over any part of the powers held by national governments and parliaments before they knew just what such a transfer of powers would involve. As Mr. Herbert Morrison, now Lord Morrison of Lambeth, put it,
there are, broadly, two alternative approaches to this problem: the functional and what I may call the federalist or institutional. Up to date, the approach has been functional in character, and let us not underestimate the remarkable advances that have been made under this mechanism of the functional approach. But I would not be dogmatic. I do not say that the functional approach is necessarily the solution for all time, nor that some collective European authority of a democratic character may not in due course develop with specific powers to decide certain matters direct. New ideas do not frighten me. I just want to know, with some precision, what the new ideas are and what they mean. We need the facts, honestly sought for and impartially set out. The peoples of Europe need the facts. When we have them, let the argument proceed. And I, for one, am prepared to reserve my final judgment until then.
The Scandinavians shared the British reluctance to envisage federal solutions. Thus, Mr. Finnmo, a prominent Norwegian representative, said,
"The reason for this, let us call it negative attitude, on the part of Great Britain and the Scandinavian countries towards a federal approach, is not any dislike of the federal principle or any opposition to European cooperation. The reason is to be found in geographical and political realities, geographic and political facts, which cannot be changed by any appeals and still less by any attacks."
In the face of this opposition between the British and continental approaches, Mr. de Valera outlined the compromise solution, which was later destined to be given a practical trial.
"If the nations here on the mainland of the continent consider that they cannot wait for us, perhaps they should consider going on without us by an agreement amongst themselves for a closer union. It is with no desire to delay progress towards a union that some of us have spoken against the attempt at immediate federation."
The debate ended with a resolution of great significance for the future, by which the Assembly declared,
"The aim and goal of the Council of Europe is the creation of a European political authority with limited functions but real powers."
The 15 foreign ministers endorsed the compromise idea of an advance towards federation by only some of the member states, which had first been put forward by Mr. de Valera and subsequently approved by the Consultative Assembly as a whole. In November 1950, Count Carlo Sforza, as chairman of the Committee of Ministers, announced the ministers' decision to the Assembly in the following terms.
"Il sera dorénavant possible au Conseil de l'Europe de constituer dans son sein des ententes restreintes, des accords partiels, des autorités spécialisées, sans pour cela amoindrir ou affaiblir le cadre général de la collaboration européenne tel qu'il est conçu par les statuts et qui affirme que nous tous nous sommes nécessaires à nous tous."
Partial agreements, specialized authorities, an authority with limited functions but real powers. What did this mean in practice? Europe had not long to wait for a first example. On the 9th of May 1950, Monsieur Robert Schuman, Foreign Minister of France, proposed that the entire Franco-German production of coal and steel be placed under a single joint high authority within an organization open to all Council of Europe and OEEC countries.
This is what Monsieur Robert Schuman himself said about his proposal on the 10th of August 1950, when introducing it in the Consultative Assembly.
"La proposition qui a été faite et acceptée, si elle devient réalité telle qu'elle a été faite et acceptée, implique des virtualités que nous ne pouvons pas encore pleinement mesurer, mais qui se développeront rapidement dans le sens d'une unification complète économique et politique de l'Europe."
The Schuman plan seemed closely in line with the functional methods favored by the British and Scandinavians, for it was limited to one clearly defined sector, coal and steel. The plan required, however, that a considerable part of national powers of control over these industries should be handed over to a European authority. As a result, when it came to the point, Britain, Ireland, and the Scandinavian countries refused to take part in the negotiations. There were left the six: France, Germany, Italy, and the three Benelux countries, Belgium, Luxembourg, and the Netherlands. Inside a Europe already divided by the Iron Curtain, a second split began to open. Not everyone suspected it was a split. Indeed, the Consultative Assembly passed a resolution by a massive majority approving the Schuman Plan as perhaps the most important contribution to European unity to date. Others, however, had their doubts, particularly when they reflected that Great Britain was taking no part in this new project.
For example, Mr. Howard Macmillan, speaking in Strasbourg, expressed these views.
In spite, therefore, of much that has been done, the result has some unhappy and perhaps dangerous aspects. For the conclusion of a great European agreement dealing with the broad direction of those basic industries of Europe, which are of vital importance to the future of Europe, both for the purposes of progress in peace and of defense in war. The conclusion of such a pact, without any association, direct or indirect, of Great Britain, is to say the least regrettable. It is for us somehow to make sure that it does not prove disastrous.
Mr. Macmillan's regrets and forebodings were justified. Six countries had set out in a direction which would take them progressively further away from the others. And a fundamental development in European unity was taking place outside the body which had inspired it, the Council of Europe. Nonetheless, in those halcyon days, it seemed that Mr. Macmillan, then in the opposition, was being unnecessarily pessimistic. The movement towards the Union of Europe had already several successes to its credit. And did not Strasbourg remain its unquestioned center? The first application of the Assembly's proposals followed indeed not long after. In July 1950, OEEC set up the European Payments Union to remove the payments difficulties which confined European trade to the shackles of bilateral barters by establishing a genuinely multilateral payment system financed by automatic long-term credits. In the economic field, it was the role of the Council to throw out ideas which were put into practice by more specialized bodies. In the field of human rights, it acted itself. A group of members of the Assembly, including such names as Sir David Maxwell Fyfe, now Viscount Kilmuir, the present Lord Chancellor of Great Britain, Monsieur Tetchin of France, Monsieur Rollin of Belgium, Monsieur Azara of Italy, Lord Leighton, and Father Beaufort of Holland, set to work on a European Convention for the Protection of Human Rights and Fundamental Freedoms. The Human Rights Convention was signed at the end of 1950 and came into force 3 years later. It sets up international machinery, in fact, supranational machinery, for the effective protection of democratic rights and freedoms. And it is an achievement of which free Europe can be proud. The six who had joined in the European coal and steel community had meanwhile started to negotiate something bolder. This time they proposed to pool not their coal and steel, but their soldiers in a new supranational organization to be called the European Defense Community. The idea sprang from the proposal for a European army, which was made at Strasbourg by Winston Churchill himself in August 1950.
We ought to make our united convictions known. We should now send, today, a message of confidence and courage from the House of Europe to the whole world. Not only should we reaffirm our allegiance to the United Nations, but we should make a gesture of practical and constructive guidance, pointing the way, or pointing some marches on the way, by declaring ourselves in favor of the immediate creation of a European army under a unified command, and in which all should bear a worthy and an honorable part.
Once again, only six countries were prepared to act on the proposal, and the negotiations took place outside the Council of Europe. This time, however, there was a significant difference, for Britain was at least prepared to participate in the negotiations and to consider ways of associating herself closely with the new defense community when it was set up. At the end of 1951, Sir David Maxwell Fife, sent to Strasbourg to speak on behalf of His Majesty's government, felt able to give the Assembly a strong assurance of Britain's interest in the matter.
I cannot promise you that our eventual association with the European defense community will amount to a full and unconditional participation. Because this, as I've said, is a matter which must, in our view, be left for intergovernmental discussion elsewhere. But I can assure you, Mr. President, of our determination that no genuine method shall fail for lack of the thorough examination which one gives to the needs of trusted comrades.
At a press conference afterwards, Sir David added that the United Kingdom was thus not closing the door on British participation in the European defense community. But that selfsame evening, Mr. Eden, then Foreign Secretary, speaking in Rome, announced without qualification that Britain would not in fact participate. When the news of Eden's statement hit Strasbourg, there was general consternation, which was shared by most of the British delegates. What could it mean except that the United Kingdom had no constructive or consistent policy towards the unification of Europe? The incident was to have grave consequences. One of the first was the decision of Monsieur Paul-Henri Spaak to resign from the presidency of the Assembly, a post he had held from the beginning, in order to work for the union of those countries who were really prepared to do something about it. Mr. Spaak minced no words when giving the reasons for his resignation.
J'ai fait une autre constatation, celle-là plus grave et plus douloureuse au cours de cette dernière session. Mesdames et messieurs, je voudrais ne froisser personne et employer les termes parlementaires les plus convenables, mais j'ai acquis cette conviction que dans cette Assemblée, il n'y a pas plus de 60 membres qui croient vraiment à la nécessité de faire l'Europe. Bien sûr, tout le monde dit « je suis bon Européen », et M. Gordon Walker le disait hier encore avec un peu d'irritation répondante à un discours de M. Paul Reynaud, et je lui dis tout de suite, je suis convaincu, mon cher collègue, de votre complète sincérité, mais ce dont je suis également convaincu avec la même et profonde conviction, c'est que quand vous dites « je suis un bon Européen », ça n'est évidemment pas la même chose que quand je le dis moi-même. Nous voyons les choses de manière tout à fait différente. Et s'il n'y avait pas quelque chose peut-être d'un peu prétentieux à dire ceci, je vous dirais, notre perspective historique à l'heure actuelle n'est pas semblable.
Monsieur Spaak resigned when the Consultative Assembly was at the height of its prestige and influence. By the end of 1951, it had in fact established itself as the European Forum. As was proved by the acceptance of the United States Congress of an invitation to send a delegation to Strasbourg for 5 days of public debate on European and Atlantic problems. These discussions, in which I took part, between an American team of 7 senators and 7 members of the House of Representatives and a slightly larger delegation of European members of Parliament, were lively and successful. A little later, the Consultative Assembly, until that time the only international parliamentary assembly in the world, was joined by a second parliamentary body. The establishment of the Coal and Steel Community brought into being another European assembly to which only the six sent representatives. There was a further difference. This new assembly had powers. Moreover, at its very first meeting, this new assembly was to be entrusted with an unexpectedly big and exciting task. Dr. Adenauer, West German Chancellor, asked it in the name of the six governments to draw up a treaty establishing yet another community, one that would go very far indeed, the European Political Community.
Sie sind in erster Linie berufen, innerhalb des Ihnen im Vertrage über die Montangemeinschaft gezogenen Rahmen tätig zu werden. Aber im Vertrauen auf die in Ihnen vorhandene Dynamik hat der Rat der Minister geglaubt, Sie bitten zu sollen, über das, was im Vertrage vorgesehen ist, hinaus eine weitere Aufgabe von sehr großer Bedeutung zu übernehmen, um so die politische Entwicklung Europas zu beschleunigen. Im Geiste der Grundsätze des Artikels 38 des Vertrages über die Gründung der Europäischen Verteidigungsgemeinschaft und unbeschadeter Bestimmungen dieses Vertrages werden die Mitglieder der Versammlung der Montangesellschaft gebeten, den Entwurf eines Vertrages über die Gründung einer europäischen politischen Gemeinschaft auszuarbeiten.
In March 1953, the six ministers duly received from the Assembly the draft treaty they had asked for. It looked as though the six had decided to take the plunge towards a true federation of their countries. And then, nothing happened. For though five of the six countries' parliaments had approved the European Defense Community, one of them had not, France. And until France had approved the Defense Community, no further progress was possible with the political community. In August 1954, the French Parliament at last took a decision. The decision was negative. France rejected the European Defense Community. In the Europe of the Six, there was widespread dismay and a sense of crisis. At this point, the House of Europe in Strasbourg became the refuge to which they returned for temporary shelter.
Mr. Bayen, then Foreign Minister of the Netherlands, had this to say.
But I think we all feel the Council of Europe is like the home where we come back to and where we try to settle those differences of approach which ask for coordination.
And at this moment, for once, Britain took the lead. Mr. Eden started on his tour of European capitals and secured agreement for a new defense organization, the Western European Union, and for Germany's rearmament and entry into NATO. The next phase opened at Messina in Sicily in the summer of 1955. There, the ministers of the Six decided on a new approach, to try to unify their countries economically in the expectation that this would lead to political unity as well. Monsieur Spark, speaking as Belgian foreign minister, reported to the consultative assembly on the Messina meeting in these words.
Notre idée générale était celle-ci. L'heure de l'Europe politique n'a pas sonné. L'échec que nous venons de subir
The failure of the European Defence Community, says Mr. Spark, proved that it was premature to try to unite Europe by the direct constitutional approach. Other methods of reaching this ultimate goal of an integrated Europe must be tried. If no progress could be made on the political front, then the more indirect approach, via functional methods of cooperation, must be attempted. At Messina, the ministers had agreed to push for the general economic integration of the six, taking advantage of the experiment already embarked upon successfully in the European Coal and Steel Community.
et qui, il faut bien le reconnaître, réussit dans le domaine de la communauté européenne du charbon et de l'acier.
In the consultative assembly, reactions to the idea were mainly enthusiastic. The governments not immediately concerned were more skeptical. The British government certainly didn't seem to think that this ambitious plan to build a European common market had much future, since for a long while they did nothing about it. But as the six-bar negotiations proceeded, there came a change. Suddenly it dawned on the other European governments that if the six succeeded in setting up a single economic unit, pursuing common policies, having nearly as many people as the United States, and within which goods and men and capital could circulate freely, this might cause hardship to those left outside. What about their own exports to the six, who intended to build a single tariff wall around them? What of the competition which this new industrial giant would exert in world markets? To solve these difficulties, it was proposed to link the six with the other European countries in a looser and broader association called the Free Trade Area. Under this arrangement, goods traded within the area would not pay customs duty, but each country would decide for itself the extent to which it would tax products coming from outside the area. Such a solution would have obvious advantages for Britain, for it would not conflict with her special arrangements with the Commonwealth. For other countries, France and Denmark, for instance, the balance of advantage was less clear. Nonetheless, negotiations for a free trade area were started in OEEC, and to begin with, the British thought that all was going well. Thus, in autumn 1957, Mr. Reginald Maudling, who had been chairman of the OEEC committee working in the free trade area, could indicate substantial progress.
The Council declares its determination to secure the establishment of a European free trade area. That goes much further and is far more definite than anything previously said by the Council of the OEEC. And I would particularly emphasize once again the words determination to secure the establishment of a European free trade area, because it was to that that all the 17 countries present at the Paris meeting unanimously subscribed.
Meanwhile, the six had signed in Rome two treaties setting up respectively a European Atomic Community, Euratom, and a General Economic Community, the Common Market. Monsieur Jean Rey, then Belgian Minister for Economic Affairs and now a member of the Common Market Executive, was convinced that the creation of the Common Market would help forward rather than hinder the establishment of a wider European Trading Association.
Je voudrais tout d'abord dire qu'il me semble que tout le monde a intérêt à la conclusion et non pas à l'échec de la négociation sur la zone de libre-échange. Il me paraît frappant que les six y ont intérêt, et ce n'est pas une formule vaine qu'ils ont mis dans le préambule du traité de Rome lorsqu'ils ont affirmé leur volonté de faire en sorte que leur effort soit un effort d'intégration auquel ils invitent les autres États à s'associer.
Alas for these hopes. 1958, when OEEC celebrated its 10th anniversary, saw the entry into force of the common market, which was very soon to prove its value in increasing the prosperity of the six countries and vastly expanding trade between them. But 1958 was to end with the complete breakdown of the free trade area negotiations conducted under the auspices of OEEC. It was to see also a serious deterioration in the relations between Britain and France, and the opening of a crack in Europe which jeopardizes nearly all that has been achieved in 10 years of cooperation. For that crack is not yet repaired. And who can tell how long it will take before it is repaired, or how it can be done? It is an ironical fact that it was also in 1958 that the extent of what the European countries had achieved by working together, of the fantastic progress made by Europe in the economic field initiated by the Marshall Plan, became clear to the whole world. For example, the convertibility of European currencies was at last achieved.
Here is Ludwig Erhard, German Vice Chancellor and Minister for Economic Affairs, addressing the Consultative Assembly in April 1959.
Ein wirklich geschichtliches Ereignis aber hat die Wirksamkeit einer Koordinierung unter den europäischen Nationen besonders klar unter Beweis gestellt. Das war eben die Einführung der Konvertierbarkeit Ende 1958. Dieses Ereignis bedeutet die Krönung einer langen und mühsamen Arbeit im Streben nach einer völligen Befreiung des internationalen Handels- und Zahlungsverkehrs von künstlichen Beschränkungen. Die Konvertierbarkeit bedeutet darüber hinaus die völlige und in gewisser Weise unwiderrufliche Integration der europäischen Wirtschaft in einem weiteren Rahmen der Weltwirtschaft.
OEEC had thus successfully completed its task of freeing trade and payments. In a Europe now booming, it moved to increase prosperity yet further by improving industrial efficiency through the European Productivity Agency. The new field of atomic energy offered another opportunity for effective European cooperation. In Norway, in Belgium, and in Britain, joint projects have been launched which are financed and staffed on a European basis.
There was other progress made. The work of simplifying frontier formalities, of getting rid of visas, of international car papers, as far as possible, of passports, was tackled successfully by both the Council of Europe and OEEC. In the cultural field, the Council of Europe embarked on an ambitious program, which led up to the creation of a cultural fund to finance European projects of cultural or scientific interest. In social matters, the European countries agreed to bring their national laws closer together and, increasingly, to grant to each other's citizens the same rights as are enjoyed by their own nationals. A European social charter has been prepared, guaranteeing to all citizens certain fundamental social and economic rights. The European Court of Human Rights came into being, a real court with powers to judge cases in which a European country has been accused of not having fully respected the democratic rights and freedoms which it has pledged itself to do.
But all this, valuable as it is unfortunately of little importance so long as Europe is divided on the fundamental question of its economic organization, and that division remains profound. During 1959, certain European countries outside the six, Britain, the three Scandinavian countries, Portugal, Austria, and Switzerland, took steps to meet the ugly situation created by the failure to set up a general European free trade area. These countries, sometimes called the Outer Seven in opposition to the Inner Six, have now formed their own little free trade area. They've done it partly to protect their own trade, partly to make it easier to reach the overall European solution upon which the future of European cooperation depends and which the Council of Europe has consistently advocated. Here is what the late John Edwards, the only Englishman to be elected president of the Consultative Assembly, had to say on this point.
To my mind, we must say, as the Council of Europe, that we want economic unity in Europe for all Europe. Let me make myself clear. I have myself said on numerous occasions that I believe in the European Economic Community and the six power communities generally. I'm sure that we owe them a great debt of gratitude for their leadership and for being in the successful vanguard of the European idea. But it cannot possibly be in the interests of the European people as a whole to have groups forming now in Northern Europe, in Central Europe, perhaps tomorrow in Southern Europe. And I think it's the duty of the Council of Europe to reaffirm this broad principle of European unity to all the member states which we want to see achieved.
This has been the story of 10 years' effort to unite Europe. It ends with a question mark. For although the Council of Europe has vigorously reaffirmed the broad principle of European unity, at the moment that principle remains seriously threatened. And we, who are in the middle of this story, cannot predict whether it will have a happy ending. But this we can say. What has happened in Europe since the war is unprecedented, and on this account, not without hope. As far back as our history goes, our countries have vied with each other, often with arms, often by means only slightly less deadly. Since 1948, they have, at any rate till very recently, been doing the opposite. Instead of fighting, they've become allies. Instead of picking each other's pockets, they've joined together in OEC to bring about a level of prosperity for all, never before attained by any. Europe, in fact, has made a new departure. Not, as yet it must be said, a completely successful one. I think that all of us who have been members of the Council of Europe would agree that, as well as being an exhilarating experience, it has also been a frustrating one. Something has been achieved. A good deal, in fact. Certainly more than is realized. But I can't help thinking that less has been achieved than should have been. Less at all events than we thought and hoped and dreamed of at The Hague in 1948. Less, I think, than is needed if Europe is now to achieve real unity. The pity of it is that if the Council of Europe had been effectively backed by governments, it could have done all that was wanted. The machinery was all right. What has been lacking is the will on the part of governments to use it. Apart from its intrinsic interest, there's another reason why Europe's history over the last 10 years is worth our attention. We can learn from our mistakes. It's fair to say that Britain has made many mistakes in Europe since the war. So have several other countries, but Britain must bear the main responsibility. Have we learned from these mistakes? Perhaps we're beginning to. When, for instance, I recall the patronizingly negative speeches made by some of my compatriots in the early days of the Consultative Assembly, and compare them with what Selwyn Lloyd has just said in Strasbourg, it's quite clear that there's been a considerable change of attitude.
We regard ourselves as part of Europe, for reasons of sentiment, of history, and geography. The fact that the Alps and the Pyrenees have been more easily crossed in war than the Channel doesn't disqualify us in the United Kingdom from European status. It's true that we have also another association, but it is one not incompatible with our European status. Our Queen is head of the Commonwealth, and that fact of the Commonwealth, with its widely differing peoples, has certain constitutional and economic consequences which must be taken into account. But it does not disqualify us from European status. We are also members of the Atlantic Community. But again, that is not inconsistent with European status because we share that position with many other European countries. And a larger Atlantic Community does not preclude a European association.
Britain, it seems, has learnt after 10 years that she must be in the new Europe now being built. But just as she learns it, Europe, or an important part of it, begins to think that perhaps she can get by without Britain. When I think back to 1950 and remember the influence in Europe which Britain then had and now has no longer, when I remember the way in which Europe turned to Britain and waited trustingly for the lead that never came, it makes me more than sad. Almost contemptuously, Britain threw her chance of leading Europe away and now regrets it. Will it be the turn of others to have regrets 10 years hence? Is it already too late? Perhaps it isn't. The Consultative Assembly itself showed a possible way out 8 years ago when it produced the so-called Strasbourg Plan for linking the economies of the European countries and their overseas associates. It was a good plan, even although I played some part in drafting it. And whatever the governments may have thought of it, it remains so. Perhaps I may be permitted to recall what I myself said about it in Strasbourg.
Our trouble now is that in this new modern world, with the huge totalitarian economy of the Soviet Union on one side of us and the vast protected economy of the United States on the other, the area of any economic system which is to stand on its own feet between the two must be enlarged. We want, therefore, to extend the preferential system so as to cover both the British Commonwealth and Western Europe, because we believe, those of us who advocate this policy, that from an economic point of view, we are dependent upon each other, that one can provide the capital goods, the manufactured goods, the other can provide the raw materials that are essential for us, and it's only by combining those two that we can ever hope to escape dependence.
That was in 1952. It still makes sense in 1960. Why? Because, in the words of Guy Mollet, the larger the framework, the easier the solution will be to find. We are engaged in a great experiment which, measured against the background of history, has hardly begun, but in which the experience of the parliamentarians who have been meeting at Strasbourg during the past 10 years must be of great value. Peace is not yet made. We're still living under the terms of armistices negotiated in 1945, which divided Europe not on the basis of political, ethnical, or economic considerations, but of military operations. The Iron Curtain is where the Red Armies happened to meet the armies of the West when the fighting stopped. The unity of Western Europe is not the same thing as the unity of the whole of Europe. And we shall find no permanent solution of the problems that confront us on the basis of the 6 or even of the 15. Let us therefore seek always to expand rather than contract the unities of the free world, and ultimately of the world as a whole.
This program has been brought to you by Resonance 104.4 FM. If you liked what you heard and want to support our work, please make a donation at fundraiser.resonance.fm.